Now, before we get into today's show, like all of you, everyone here is in shock about the shooting in Texas. For many thousands of people who survived the Las Vegas Strip shooting on October 1st, 2017, I'm sure this only adds to the emotional toll from that awful night when 60 people died and more than 800 were injured. And today's State of Nevada after today's State of Nevada program, NPR's Here and Now will go into a lot more detail about the Texas shooting. State of Nevada also plans to more coverage in the coming days, looking at Nevada's laws and safety in our schools. Today, though, we're talking about congressional hearings that occurred last week that have more to do with Nevada than a lot of people might realize. Members of Congress held a hearing about our military pilots reporting and recording unidentified aerial phenomena, UAPs they call them. They used to call them UFOs. And they weren't laughing. They weren't poking fun at each other. They weren't making fun of anything. Instead, they talked about national security and the potential threat that these craft pose to the country. The usual questions came up. What are they? Where are they from? Are they Russian, Chinese, or are they ours? Are they being built or researched in Nevada, in the desert north of Las Vegas at Area 51 and the adjoining site, S4? And are we, is this country or the world ready? Ready to hear the story of what's really going on? For that matter, do people in the upper echelons of government know what's going on? Now, with me today is George Knapp. He's a longtime journalist in Las Vegas. He's won two Peabody Awards, which is the Pulitzer Prize for broadcast reporting. And for decades, he's done serious reporting on the UFO phenomena. George, welcome back.
Joe, good to see you, always.
Great to have you here. So let's go to this congressional meeting. Pretty remarkable that they had the hearing, the first one in 54 years. Why did it happen?
Combination of factors. One, largely because of public interest. In December of 2017, the New York Times breaks this story about a secret program called ATIP. $22 million secured by Harry Reid. They got some of the key information wrong. Harry Reid did secure $22 million for a study. Robert Bigelow did get the contract from the DIA, and this program did take place, but it wasn't called ATIP. It was called OSAP. It was probably the largest government-funded UFO program in history, both in terms of the number of employees. They had 50 full-time employees working here in Las Vegas, investigators and data analysts and computer folks and ex-cops and ex-military, 50, compared to, say, Project Blue Book, which had three or four, or ATIP, which had – it was a really good program, and we'll get into it further, but it had no full-time employees. The guys who were working on ATIP in different agencies had other full-time jobs. So 50 full-time people working on nothing but this. That program produced a massive UFO database that the members of Congress were completely ignorant about, 200,000 cases. The work that they did was kept secret. It came out in that New York Times story, and that started a cascade of media interest. Other media figured, well, if the New York Times can do this story, we'll do it. And so stories, people started digging into it. 60 Minutes did stories. NBC, all the networks did it. Other media around the world did it. And that really generated a lot of interest by members of Congress. That story in December 2017 started a series of closed-door classified briefings by members of Congress, started in January 2018. First, it was senior staff members. And then it was elected members of Congress on the Senate Intelligence, Senate Armed Services, and then in the House committees. And it became a pretty hot ticket really fast. They started bringing in witnesses who had worked on the programs that we're going to talk about, who had had these close encounters with things like the Tic Tac and the gimbal and Go Fast and the videos that the world has now seen. And they came in and told lawmakers flat out. Over the series of the next two or three years, there were others who came in who had worked on these programs, high-level Navy guys, high-level intelligence agency guys and gals, and they showed them other stuff that we have not been able to see. We've heard only rumors about it, videos, photos, things of that sort about what's in there. A few of those images have been released by myself and Jeremy Corbell, and they've gone all over the world. But all the people who have come out of those meetings, all of them have sort of a deer-in-the-headlights look when they get out, and they're asked, you know, what is it? They can't say. And they can't say what they've seen, but they're all clearly affected by the information that was provided to them. So You know, I know we'll get into the question of, is this technology ours? Is it Russian? Is it Chinese? Well, the answer in a simple one word is no. The fact that they had this hearing at all is amazing. It was driven by media interest and then public interest. Congress responded to that. And when they started asking questions about what does our intelligence establishment really know, they got some answers. And the answers were very unsettling. So they had a public hearing. And I hope it's the first of many to come. As you mentioned, it was 54 years since the last one. They had two of them in the 1960s. The first one in 1966 was instigated largely at the behest of a congressman named Gerald Ford, who represented the central Michigan area. There had been an incident in Michigan. A whole lot of witnesses who had seen this thing in the sky, this weird craft. And then Project Blue Book comes in. J. Allen Hynek comes in. They investigate for a couple days, and then they announce at a news conference, they said, we think it might be caused by swamp gas. Well, people went ballistic, and now swamp gas is sort of a synonym for a cover-up. You know, it's preposterous. And they were really mad. They expressed their anger to their congressman, Gerald Ford, who was House Minority Leader at the time, and he really was the driving force behind that hearing. Mostly that hearing was government officials who tried to downplay it as much as they could. In 1968, there was a second public hearing. And at that one, they had input from UFO investigators, Stan Friedman, Jacques Vallée. They submitted papers, and it made quite an impact on Congress. But again, Congress has a lot of stuff on its plate. And if the public doesn't stay on top of it and force them to stay on this, they'll move on to something else. So 68, Nixon's elected. There's a lot of things going on in Washington. They dropped the ball on UFOs. A year later, after that hearing, Project Blue Book, the Air Force canceled it. Nothing to see here, folks. We can't find any national security implications. There's no scientific value to studying this further. We're going to get rid of it. And then it went away. Supposedly, that was the last government study. That was the last UFO program. That was a lie. That research continued. Well, of course it had to. You know, you have UFOs flying over Navy bases, buzzing ships, and in particular going over nuclear weapons facilities, nuclear storage areas, things of that sort. It is a national security concern, and that's why the information continued to be collected, though it wasn't in some organized program. So the fact that Congress held another hearing 54 years later in response to public and media pressure is a really big deal. You know, there were a lot of good things that came out of this hearing, also a lot of bad ones that we can get into.
Yeah, you did a follow-up story on this, and I think one of the takeaways I got from your story was, did they ask the right questions? And should they have had experts in their technological experts asking better questions?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, I was actually impressed by three members of that intelligence committee that had clearly done their homework. Adam Schiff, who was the chairman of the larger committee, intelligence committee, he asked some good stuff. Carson, the chairman of the subcommittee, had some good statements and asked great questions. And then this guy, Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin, Republican, he asked the most pertinent questions of the day. He had done his homework. The fact is, those two witnesses couldn't answer those questions. And when the answers that they did provide were incredibly unsatisfactory, and we can get into them if you want to go through
I do kind of want to know what your takeaway is from the congressional hearings. What did we learn? Or, you know, part of the reason for the hearings was they kept saying national security. We don't know what these are. The way they fly is something we don't have the technology to do that right now. Could it be another country? And if it is another country, we have to be at the forefront of this, not them. And whoever owns this technology is going to be ahead of every country for decades to come.
Yeah, whoever gets this technology and can duplicate it, they win. That's it. That's period. Because this technology, these things have been flying around in our airspace for a long time and underwater and over sensitive facilities. It's 75 years. This year marks 75 years since the beginning of the modern era, UFO era. Kenneth Arnold had his sightings in Washington State in July of 75 years ago with the Roswell incident. Something crashed. That was the first big UFO wave. And we were seeing the same kinds of craft back then that we're seeing now. Were they Chinese drones in 1947? I don't think so. Were they Russian technology? No. They weren't ours. We know because we now have a paper trail where the military, before FOIA ever existed, were discussing behind closed doors, whose are they? This is pretty serious. And they would spell it out. This is not visionary or fictitious. It's real. And those same kinds of documents and reports and statements from military officials, intelligence officials, have continued ever since. We don't know what they are. Now, obviously, there are probably 90% of UFO sightings are easily explainable, prosaic. That's a misidentification of a plane or some other kind of balloon or secret project or clouds or planets, things of that sort. But that remaining 5 to 7% is not easily explained, and that's really been the focus of these secret government studies that we'll get into. These guys in Congress know, they've been briefed now behind closed doors for a couple of years. They know damn good and well these are not ours. They're not. And one of the reasons the UAP task force was put together is to coordinate with other departments, other agencies, contractors, to find out, are you guys flying something in this airspace where you're not supposed to be, and it's confusing us about UFOs? And the answer is no, those are not ours. They're not Chinese as far as we know, and they're not Russian. So, you know, I was really encouraged by the hearing that it took place at all. I was encouraged that some members of Congress asked pretty good questions. The others seemed to be either uninterested or completely uninformed. What was really discouraging is these two guys in the Pentagon who came in didn't seem to know their butt from a hole in the ground about UFOs, about the history of this phenomena, and about programs that our government has paid for, studies that happened. You know, there were some pointed questions that asked in between Project Blue Book, which ended in 69, and ATIP, which was revealed to exist in 2017, was there anything else? Did you have contracts with any private contractors to study this stuff or deal with materials, suggesting crash retrieval programs that mm-hmm. we can get into? And the answer was no. Well, they lied. The biggest program we ever had, OSAP, which is based here, which was one of the primary reasons this congressional hearing happened in the first place, these guys don't have a clue that it existed. It created the biggest UFO database in the world. You know, they were talking about their the move toward reducing the stigma for military pilots, service members, how that has already resulted in an increase in the number of cases. A year ago, when the UAP task force issued its report, they said, we got 144 cases that we've studied from 2004 on, military encounters with UFOs. Of those, 143 cannot be explained. Since then, in the year since that report came out, the database has grown to 400 because more pilots have come forward and reported things. That's good. But the fact is, public money paid for a program based here in Las Vegas that produced a database with 200,000 UFO cases, 200,000. And the members of Congress who were sitting there asking questions seemingly have no idea that it existed. They funded it. They don't even know about it. It's very frustrating.
A lot of questions about this congressional hearing. And so does Sean Cahill. Sean, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, George.
Hey, Sean.
It's great to have you here, Sean. And by the way, I want to, if people want to call and chime in, you are a big part of the conversation today. The number is 702-258-3552. That's 702-258-3552. Email is son@knpr.org. If you want to send a message on Twitter, our handle is @KNPRNews, and our Facebook page is Nevada Public Radio. So, Sean, again, he is a retired U.S. Navy Chief Master at Arms. In 2004, he was aboard the USS Princeton, 100 miles from the coast, southwest of San Diego, when the now infamous Tic Tac UFO video was filmed by military pilots. So, Sean, in that congressional hearing last week, did you hear anything that surprised you?
You know, like a lot of people, I was surprised both by what I heard and what I didn't hear, and by what some folks were educated about and other areas where we got kind of, the shrug from the task force. I was very surprised to see what we call the Wilson document entered into the record. I know there's a lot of people on either side of that discussion that have a lot of feelings about it, but the fact is it's a fantastic place for us to really dig into this. It has a great deal to do with things that George and others have worked on for years, and it's a really good place to begin separating the minutia from this and start getting our legislators to ask different, more pointed and direct questions.
What is the Wilson document?
And George would be able to explain this much better than I am because he's definitely an expert in this, but it's a document that's a purported conversation between a couple of people at a specific location about various things. I'd love to throw that to George because he truly is.
Okay, George, go ahead.
So Admiral Thomas Wilson was head of the DIA, And if you're looking for somebody who might know where the bodies are buried, literally, bodies and craft, things of that sort, he might be one who'd know. Well, he shared some information with a colleague of ours, Eric Davis. He came to Las Vegas. Eric Davis, who worked for NIDS for a number of years and then was also hired to work as a – he's a physicist. He was hired to work for BASS, the AUSAP program that we've been talking about, this big DIA-funded program. In between those two, he has a meeting with Admiral Wilson here in Las Vegas. And he took notes, and they discussed crash retrievals, meaning flying saucers that crashed that were retrieved by our government. That sort of goes to the heart of the story that I was working on in 1989, Bob Lazar, Area 51, S4. And those rumors have been around for a long time. Is it possible that our government has retrieved things that fell out of the sky or were left, technology that we do not have, technology that we could use as a model to sort of take apart, reverse engineer, and figure it out? Admiral Wilson indicated that he had direct information about these crash retrieval programs hidden in special access programs, SAPs. He shared that with Eric, who took all these notes down, and they were secret. And they were kept secret until Dr. Edgar Mitchell, sixth man to walk on the moon, who had been part of Robert Bigelow's organization here in Las Vegas, he died, and a lot of his papers got out, and that was one of the papers that got out. And it set off this intense debate about whether it was real. Admiral Wilson has denied it, denies ever meeting with Eric Davis, and denies knowing anything about crash retrievals or UFOs stashed somewhere. But the fact is, Eric is a pretty solid guy, has worked on classified programs, is working on classified programs now, and he doesn't make stuff up. I believe him because I remember at the time when it happened, there was discussion among a very small group of people that I know really well that it was real. And so one of the congressmen, Congressman Gallagher, that I mentioned before, asked a question. What about the Wilson-Davis documents? These guys looked like they had no clue what they were talking about. And maybe they didn't know what he's talking about. But the congressman said, well, can you check into it? Yeah, okay, we'll look into it. So there's a possibility that Admiral Wilson will be called forward as a witness at the next public hearing, assuming there is another one. And it opens up the really important question of, do we have hardware? Do we have bodies and hardware? The stories that started with Roswell that have continued through this day, do we have it? And that was also pertinent to the question that was asked about contracts. Did our government make contracts with private entities to deal with this stuff? I think the answer is yes. I think those witnesses either were lying or they are ignorant about what's been going on. And if Congress now has put that onto the record, that they have asked these guys and called them on the carpet, we want you to dig into this. If that becomes a genuine inquiry and leads to the goodies, that would be huge because that's the physical proof that people have demanded. If it exists, if there are craft, like Bob Lazar said he worked on out there from somewhere else that were built by someone far in advance of our technology, that's the ballgame.
You know a lot more than you often talk about on this program. Do you know if those goodies, as you put it, actually do exist here? And are they at Area 51 potentially?
Well, I tend to think that they were out there, but they're not there anymore. I can't imagine with all the scrutiny that our stories have put on Area 51 that would still be stashed there. I think they're probably moved, assuming that they have them at all. I'll just tell you that I've been pretty far up the food chain, and the answer is yes. People that I know and trust who have seen it, who've seen this stuff. You know, in the original New York Times story that came out 2017, it noted that Bigelow Aerospace, which was the contractor to the DIA on this program, had spent money to prepare its facility to receive these materials. I thought they got them, but they didn't. They never received it. But they did, as we told in our book, Skinwalkers at the Pentagon, they went looking. The guys from BASS went looking, knocking on the door. They had high security clearances. They went to a number of different agencies. And the closer they got, the stronger the resistance was, to the point where the door was literally slammed in their face, basically told, don't ask about this again. Because they were trying to, if they had been successful, as Reed tried to do in establishing a special access program, the plan was to get it, to get a look at it, to analyze it, to figure it out, and have some more eyes dealing with the problem of can we duplicate this technology. The door was slammed in their face so vociferously that they came away believing this is real, it's hidden somewhere, they think they know where it is. I've been told where it is, and That's not a story I can do right now.
Well, there was a point in the hearing when the Pentagon's top intelligence official made a sort of cryptic remark. He said, "We aren't sure what they are." He's talking about UAPs. But he also said, "We don't want to let on to other countries what we know about what they are and about these subjects." So, can we ever trust anything that ever comes out when they say anything about what a UAP is or where it comes from or what we actually know?
Well, I'd say no. I mean, Sean in on this, but go ahead, Sean.
Go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, well, I want to take us back up just a little bit and talk about what the UAPTF is, what it's made of, and what we should expect out of that. Because George made a very salient point. The folks that we had up there on the stand giving their testimony were not what we would call UFO experts. But the only UFO expert in the government that we know of at this moment was recently Lou Elizondo, and he's not a part of the government anymore. So where these people were sourced from were within the departments that had cognizant authority. So it's unlikely to find a UFO expert there. But as we were saying, a lot of things were left out of the testimony that should have been there, and a lot of education that we think they should have known they didn't. As we mentioned, the Wilson document, there's also the Malmstrom case with Colonel Robert Salas. And beyond that, giving us just Blue Book as proof that this has been investigated was very, very silly to me. I mean, they could have immediately went to Project Sign, which, 1947 to 1949 was an Air Force project, which established that UFOs appeared to represent actual aircraft, but there was not enough data to determine their origin. This is 1947 to 1949. 1949 Project Grudge. They basically said some of these are real, but we don't know what they all are, and they closed it. In 1953, the Joint Chiefs of Staff had a letter of promulgation that put a $10,000 fine on military personnel discussing classified UFO cases specifically. 52 to 69 was Project Blue Book, and 66 to 68 was the Condon Committee, a Colorado UFO project funded by the United States Air Force. All of those things should have been part of the preamble leading up to discussing Blue Book. And it would have given the congressman a very different view of how long this has been going on and how many times it's been stovepiped. So this lack of oversight, this lack of a clearinghouse to go to, I think they were stymied by that, because it's kind of like you make a phone call and you say, "Give me all your stuff on UFOs," and they say, "What stuff on UFOs?" Because maybe the person you called is part of that compartmentalized understanding. So I think we have a long road ahead of us. We just saw that the very first opening moves of something that the folks that are investigating it had a lot of investigating to do just to get up to speed to conduct a proper investigation.
That's Sean Cahill. He's a retired Navy Master at Arms, and he was aboard the USS Princeton during the now declassified Tic Tac UAP incident off in the Pacific Ocean. But Sean, after that incident, again, you're retired. And now I'll just say you sort of investigate UAPs, and you're part of that, that whole culture now. But I wonder if that incident changed something in you at the time.
A lot of people have asked me that, because there seems to be a status quo for a lot of people to have some kind of awakening or change in personality after witnessing such a profound thing. For me, I had kind of already been in that place where I was a believer, per se. And in 2004, I kind of went in a different direction. The aloof nature that my chain of command put on this whole incident, and the way that it was brushed aside at the time, I decided, I'm not going to believe in this stuff anymore. This must be a program of ours or something like that, or I'm misunderstanding this. Now, I felt that way for years. And after I retired, I had, like a lot of people, I had a hard time taking off the uniform. I did go through some changes and some growth. And it made me look back at that incident again, but it wasn't until Lou came out and really said, "This really happened. This was real." I had friends calling me, family going, "Wow, this is the thing you told us about in 04. I kind of had to come back to it. And so when I say that I opened a personal investigation at that time, I really started digging in deep to it. And when I got to know Lou a little bit better and got to have some more candid conversations with him about some of his impressions, not necessarily conclusions and certainly not classified information, But I realized that this was worth my time. This was worth taking my talent, if I might say that, as an investigator and applying it in my retired life to something.
George Knapp, you know, when we talk about UFOs, UAPs, listeners might assume we're talking about space aliens. We used to have Harry Reid, the late Harry Reid, on many times, and he would never, ever say these are otherworldly. In fact, he'd go out of his way to make sure no one thought they were. But I wonder if some people might hear that. I've talked to people in my life. You mention that to them, and they just tune out. They basically, literally cover their ears. They don't want to hear it. But that's not necessarily, though, what we're talking about here, is it, or is it?
You know, one of the reasons they changed UFO to UAP is because of the baggage that comes with UFO. The assumption when you use that acronym, those letters, the assumption being that it's flying saucers from outer space, aliens from other planets. The fact is, we don't know. I'm not sure anyone knows where they're from, why they're here. All the big questions we can't answer. But we can say that they're not ours. Lou Elizondo's the hero of this story. If he hadn't come forward, then the world probably would not hear about what was done, Bigelow and Reed getting together, creating this program, OSAP, that later became ATIP, and then became the UAP Task Force. I mean, the dominoes start right here and lead right to there. The first case that these guys investigated here was Tic Tac. So on the day that they're setting up the BASS, OSAP, sorry for all the acronyms, this program, the secret study, First guy they interviewed had been one of the pilots, one of the aviators involved in the Tic Tac case, and that's when they started their investigation. They started the first investigation into the Tic Tac. I have seen this document. It's never been made public. It's between 200 and 300 pages, the analysis of the technology. It is not ours. We can't fly it. You'll notice in the hearing, the Tic Tac case came up. Sean can talk more about it than I can, but they asked these witnesses about Tic Tac, and yeah, we still can't explain that one. But they implied in their language that although they can't explain it, if they had more information, they could. No, they can't. They can't. It's not our technology. We didn't have that technology in 2004 when the Tic Tac incident happened. We don't have it today. We certainly didn't have it in 1947 through the 60s, which is when these things were seen flying around doing the same things that Tic Tac did. So,
okay, George, we don't have that technology. We didn't develop it.
No.
But you yourself were talking moments ago about the Wilson-Davis document and how this high Pentagon official talked about basically back engineering downed aircraft. Might we have it that way?
Well, we might. You know, if you believe the Bob Lazar story, and I understand a lot of people do not, what the problems are with that whole account. If you believe that story, is we've been working at it for a long time and we just haven't been successful. That's why they brought somebody like him in, is to have a different pair of eyes on this, think outside the box, is that we have not been able to duplicate their technology. We might have had rudimentary parts of it that we've been able to master. There are some pretty significant stories about Russia being able to develop an energy weapon that is based on their own UFO investigation program. I don't know that that'll ever be confirmed, but I don't think that we have that technology. I mean, I think we have it and we've been studying it, but we haven't mastered it yet.
Stephanie on Twitter writes, either to George or to Sean, how do you think we can create less fear in our society surrounding these unexplainable phenomena? And Sean Cahill, I'm going to put that to you.
Well, that's a really good question, because what we're talking about the unknown, and inherently the unknown brings fear to most folks. But what we can do is at the risk of offending a number of people who consider themselves experiencers, in general, the populace is not experiencing negative effects of this phenomenon, to my knowledge. So it being an existential threat, something that keeps you up at night, something that truly worries you, I don't think you should worry about it any more than lightning, frankly. Or, you know, but that said, as you become more educated to anything that inspires fear in people or the unknown, you learn about it. And so you don't run out into a lightning storm with a metal pole, you know, and you don't go swimming when there's lightning and things like that. Mm-hmm. But that almost indicates that there is some kind of negative or scary aspect of this. I can't say that there's not. There's the folks that have encountered this, whether intellectually or physically, it's very polarizing. You have usually two groups of folks, those that are very inspired by it and those that are very fearful of it, and very few that are sitting in the middle, you know, without an idea of it. So the way to reduce the fear, I think, is first to reduce the stigma. I think people need to know that if you do speak up, you're not going to be seen as crazy. We're at the point where we need to hear what we all used to consider the crazy, because since this is finally on the table, we have to bring everything out in the right spots. Now, does that stuff that would be more, you know, off the wall for some folks, does that belong in the hearings? I don't think it does immediately. I think that needs to proceed at the proper pace. But I think that the offshoots of whether it's foundations or think tanks or working groups or, you know, and existing groups like, you know, MUFON, the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, and others like that, I'm looking forward to hearing their voices. I'm looking forward to them telling us who they've been working with and telling us who they had contact with in the government, because we're seeing that from MUFON now. They're finally coming out and saying, listen, we were a part of this too. And I'm not saying people are coming out tooting their horns for credit. A lot of people are finally saying, listen, now that a lot of this work is done, we just wanted to let you know that we helped. And I think that's great, because the more people that say, hey, I helped, that's an open connection right there to connect in the public eye and to share data.
Yeah. So George Knapp, I'm sorry, Sean. George Knapp, we talk about fear. Sean made a reference early in the program to an incident at an Air Force base. I think it's called Maelstrom, in Air Force Base. And it goes to the heart of whether or not people should be fearful, or whether if this is otherworldly technology, whether or not it's benevolent or malevolent. Talk about that incident and other similar incidents around the world. And I'm really curious about your opinion about... Well, I'll ask you that question later.
Well, the Congressman Gallagher asked a question about the Malmstrom incident. This is where UFOs were seen over nuclear missile sites and seemingly disabled. They appeared over these missile sites and disabled the weapons. As Harry Reid has said in a couple of interviews, probably with you, Joe, you know, if we had needed to use those missiles, if we had gone to war, they were inoperative. That is a national security matter. But it wasn't just Malmstrom. There was a whole series of events. They call it the Northern Tier. We've got five different bases along the U.S.-Canadian border where we've got nukes, our nukes. And each time they were visited by UFOs that would appear over them and were very interested in the nuclear weapons part of it. And in some cases, they disabled missiles. In Russia, the same thing happened when I went there in the 90s a couple of times. They had an incident where their nuclear missiles were enabled. They were ready to fire, aimed at the United States, and these Russians could not stop them. They were frantically pressing buttons to stop it. They were ready to go. The UFOs appeared over the base, and then they left, and the things went back to normal. That's scary. That tells me it is a national security matter. It's not scary to the point where they launched them, and maybe they're trying to tell us something about our most powerful weapon systems, which might be a good thing. But the fact is, we don't know where they're from. You know, if I had to make a guess, I'm not saying they're extraterrestrial or interdimensional. I don't know. I don't know anybody who does know, for sure. But we don't, you know, the public says we have a right to know, and I agree. We need to know, and we can handle the truth. And in general, as a journalist, Joe, guys like us, that's our job, is to find out stuff and tell people whether they like it or not. But what is the truth? What's the ultimate agenda? We don't know what the time frame is for this intelligence, how long it's been here. Now, it's true. They haven't done an independent day on us and wiped out our cities with giant laser beams, but we don't know what their time scale is. It might just be a week to them. We don't know if they use us. There's something that they're clearly interested in with us. They study us. They study our plants, our environment. They take people. They take physical samples. We don't know what it is. So before people say, I can handle the truth, you know, maybe, but maybe not. I think about Skinwalker Ranch and the things that happened there.
Skinwalker Ranch, real briefly, is in Utah.
Yeah.
And it is a place infamous for very odd, scary phenomena.
Yeah, it was a paranormal hotspot. UFOs, cattle mutilations, Bigfoot sightings, all kinds of weird stuff. Something like poltergeist activity all in one place. And it was studied by NIDS, Bigelow's organization here.
And by the way, if people want to hear more about this, we talked with George about this when his book came out about it last year. Like I said, frightening stuff. And you even talk about the frightening stuff, but keep going.
Yeah, so the ranch was studied by a private organization that Bigelow owned, and then it became one focus of the OSAP program that the DIA oversaw. And they saw some weird stuff. This intelligence there seems to know what we're going to do before we do it. It sees us. It can watch us when we're sleeping, when we're taking a shower. It seems to be around, and we cannot detect it. It can detect us. So if the government ever comes out with an announcement, by the way, we've got some UFO information. We're in the interest of transparency. We're going to tell you these things fly around our skies. There's nothing we can do about it. They can disable our nukes. They can beat our best planes. They can go anywhere. They see us all the time. They're like Santa Claus. They know when we've been sleeping, when we've been bad and good, and thank you and good night. That's not a very reassuring message. So, before you say, I know the truth, I can handle the truth, you better be ready for what the truth might be.
Robert from, I'm assuming, Las Vegas, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. This is a two-part question for Mr. Knapp regarding the recent hearings. After the commission members Schiff and Gallagher and Carson asked their incipient questions, do you believe that the rest of the committee was either ignorant of this topic or influenced by the deep Pentagon state to prevent this coming out? And then secondly, do you think they'll ever ask any bona fide UFO researchers like Linda Howe or Jacques Vallée to speak?
Well, for the last question, I could say, yeah, I think that the next hearing will expand the boundaries beyond just military witnesses. They'll have somebody like Lou Elizondo, or maybe we did a story about some of the scientists who've been on the ground, boots on the ground, investigators, the former head of the UAP task force, a guy named John Stratton, naval intelligence, people like that, David Fravor, the pilot who was involved in the Tic Tac incident, people like Sean, other people who were on the Princeton and the Nimitz at the time. They need to call forward some of those people. They need to produce some of the videos that we know exist that members of Congress behind closed doors have seen. As for some of the members of the committee, I suspect that we heard from the three most interested and best educated members of that committee who were there asking the tough and informed questions. It could be the other members go along with it. They don't really care about it, that they're not impressed by it, or that they've got other priorities. This might be the only bipartisan issue in Washington. You didn't hear any partisan bickering during the questioning or the back and forth, which that alone makes it really interesting. So, it's like the public, there's a broad swath of interest in the UFO topic, but it always takes second base to bills and jobs and taking care of your kids.
Well, this reminds me of the famous Ronald Reagan comment to Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev back in the 1980s when they were meeting to discuss U.S.-Soviet relations in Reykjavik. Reagan asked Gorbachev this question: what would you do if the U.S. were suddenly attacked by someone from outer space? Would you help us? And Gorbachev said, no doubt. And Reagan said, we too. So I've asked this question of listeners, but George, with all the chaos in this country, the division that we now see stoked by politicians who want to get votes, do you think revelation of perhaps something that is not of this world might bring this country, even this world, together?
I think it's entirely possible. Reagan made that statement, by the way, five different times. And Gorbachev commented in public two or three times about it. And I that is one of the fears, I think, of people who want us to think of ourselves as Americans or Brits or Brazilians or whatever, is that if this was acknowledged and we start thinking of ourselves as Earthlings first and not Americans, it changes things, And I'm sure there are a lot of forces in the world that don't want that to happen.
John from Bullhead City is joining us now. John, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on. I'd like to discuss an incident that happened in June of 1968 between a United States Marine Corps fighter aircraft and the HMS Hobart, which is a warship out of Australia. I happen to be in the Philippines, and I come across these guys that were on board that ship, and they were in port for repairs. And what they stated that their ship had been struck by a United States fighter aircraft air-to-surface missile. And at the time, it killed six Australian sailors. And at the time, I thought nothing of it, and I looked on the Internet just by chance I come across this because I'm interested in the phenomena, and found that that incident involving that fighter plane and that warship, actually the warship, they found debris aboard the warship that identified the missile that was fired from the aircraft. Well, that aircraft landed when it was locked on by the warship and left the area and went back to Da Nang MAG 11 air base there, landed with its full armament. No armament was discharged. Yet they found pieces of metal that had the same identification marks as what that aircraft had been carrying. The night before that incident, there was two American River Patrol boats. One was under attack by an unknown light in the sky, and when the second patrol boat went to see what was going on, the patrol boat that was under this scrutiny began to fire at this object, and what happened was it was obliterated. It was just blown out of the water, so the second patrol boat took off, get the heck out of there. But they found later that the ammunition that hit that patrol boat was similar to the ammunition that they were discharging toward this object.